EU und Bundesregierung steigern ihre Kriegshysterie. Bundeskanzler Merz sieht Putin als neuen Hitler. Doch längst wenden sich Deutschlands internationale Partner ab. Die Raserei in Brüssel und Berlin gefährdet die neue US-Geostrategie. Plant Trump, die EU aufzuspalten? Am Montag einigten sich einige EU-Staaten unter Führung von Bundeskanzler Merz bei den Gesprächen mit ukrainischen und US-Vertretern darauf, dass nach Waffenstillstand eine multinationale Einsatztruppe in die Ukraine entsandt werden soll, angeblich um der Ukraine Sicherheit zu garantieren. Aber ist das wirklich das Hauptziel? Oder wollen sie der Ukraine erneut Zeit erkaufen, um sie aufzurüsten? Und wird Russland so einem Vorschlag jemals zustimmen?
Well, two things. One, Europe can never be trusted ever again on anything. The Minsk Accord shows this. We had Angela Merkel, we had François Hollande and Petro Poroshenko all agree to conditions that were ostensibly built around the concept of a ceasefire upon which fundamental changes would be made to the Ukrainian constitution that, would enshrine as law protections for Ukraine's Russian-speaking population. This was done in order to preserve the lives of Ukrainian soldiers who were surrounded in the Donbas town of Debaltseve. And Vladimir Putin, rather than, shove a bayonet through the heart of the Ukrainian army, agreed to be compassionate, agreed that Russia had no territorial designs on Ukrainian territory. Russia's only interests were for the safekeeping and safeguarding of Russian-speaking persons, to preserve their language, their culture, their history. The Russian side agreed to the Minsk Accords. But we now know that the Germans and the French and the Ukrainians did not negotiate in good faith. They have all acknowledged that this was a sham, simply to buy time to rebuild a Ukrainian army that could successfully launch offensive operations against the Russian-speaking population of the Donbas. They never intended to adhere to the commitments made under Minsk. And, Russian President Vladimir Putin has acknowledged that he was naive to believe that Europe was serious about something like this. And so with this historical foundation, does one really think that Russia is now going to fall for a Minsk III? No. First of all, Europe cannot be trusted ever again and will not be trusted ever again. And because of that, Europe simply doesn't matter. Russia doesn't care. This is an exercise in futility that's taking place here, where Europe is trying to earn a seat at the table. But the table isn't set until Russia sits at the table. And when Russia does sit at the table, my guess is that Europe won't be anywhere to be found, that it will be an unconditional surrender by Ukraine, who will be compelled by reality to accede to Russian demands. And the United States will have to recognize the inevitability of this. What's happening right now is that Europe is trying to elongate these negotiations. Europe's playing a political game, and I'm surprised that Donald Trump doesn't recognize this, because it's the same political game that Europe played during his first administration, seeking to run out the clock on the first 2 years of his administration while they feverishly conspired with his political opponents in the United States to prevail in a midterm election that, if the Democrats repeat what they did in Trump's first term, would result in a Congress that would paralyze the Trump administration, preventing any of these changes that Trump administration is seeking to put into play from ever occurring. This is what the Europeans are doing. The Russians know this. If you think that Russia is going to allow Ukraine to have an 800,000 strong army trained by NATO, equipped by NATO, backed up by NATO troops on their sword, I have a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you, because it just isn't going to happen. Nothing that was talked at this table is going to happen. None of the European designs are going to happen, because Europe doesn't matter. Europe doesn't count. Europe is a non-factor in every aspect of, you know, determining the conditions for conflict resolution between Ukraine and Russia.
Vergangene Woche erst sprachen wir über den schleichenden Zerfall der EU. Offenbar setzt Brüssel alles daran, diesen Prozess zu beschleunigen. Die EU-Führung will unbedingt auf die russischen Vermögenswerte zugreifen, trotz Widerstands aus mehreren Mitgliedstaaten. Statt auf Konsens will Brüssel deswegen auf ein Verfahren mit qualifizierter Mehrheit setzen. Der ungarische Ministerpräsident Orbán warnt bereits, eine Konfiskation kommt einer Kriegserklärung gleich. Was meinst du? Was passiert, wenn die EU die russischen Vermögenswerte konfisziert, und warum will sie das um jeden Preis durchsetzen?
You know, the European political and economic elites that have created the European Union and have facilitated the continuation of NATO, even though there's no legitimate reason for NATO to exist, they have built a fantasy world that requires an enemy. They have to populate it with an enemy to justify the extreme measures necessary for them to remain politically viable. That enemy is Russia. But they also need a mechanism of conflict that spares Europe the consequences of direct conflict with Russia. And that mechanism is the proxy war in Ukraine. As long as the proxy war in Ukraine is going, the European political and economic elites can manipulate a narrative justifying their continued existence. The second the Ukrainian conflict ends, the reality of the the horrific policies of these elites will become apparent to all, and it will be the end of them politically. So they need this war to continue, and that's what they're doing. And they will use whatever desperate means necessary. I mean, when people are fighting for their lives, they will do that which is necessary to survive. No matter how ridiculous it looks, from the viewpoint of more sober people. I mean, literally, Germany right now is facing a collapsing economy, political marginalization to the point of actual nullification on the part of Merz and his political party. Deindustrialization, financial collapse, everything. And so Merz is desperate to stay in power. And so he will take extreme measures needed to bolster, his political viability. And right now that means that Germany has to find a way to keep Ukraine in the fight. And in doing so, make Germany relevant to the European Union and to the region as a whole. And that's what we're seeing here. Extreme policies. I mean, the man is literally, if you listen to his speeches, he might as well be Adolf Hitler. I know he likes to accuse Vladimir Putin of being Adolf Hitler, but Merz's speeches are reminiscent of the kind of ridiculousness that, one heard in the 1930s from Adolf Hitler to justify extreme policy measures to prepare the German people for war, the militarization of society, the suppression of freedoms. This is all taking place in Germany today under Merz.
Hinter den Kulissen scheint sich der Ton zwischen Deutschland und den USA verschärft zu haben. So beklagte jüngst das Bundeswehrkommando, dass es keine direkte Kommunikation mehr mit dem US-Verteidigungsministerium habe. Bundeskanzler Merz unterstellte US-Präsident Trump Ende letzter Woche, er habe kein Verständnis für die Funktionsweise der EU. Warum verschärft sich der diplomatische Ton zwischen Berlin und Washington? Haben die USA kein Interesse mehr an der Allianz mit Deutschland?
I think what's happened here is that let's just be honest. The United States, under previous administrations, to include the first Trump administration, lured Europe into a trap in Ukraine. I mean, we didn't know it was a trap at the time, but, you know, the United States and Europe were seeing eye to eye on Russia being a threat and the utility of Ukraine as a vehicle to achieve the strategic defeat of Russia. There was a time when an American president stood side by side with the NATO allies, you know, promoting a conflict in Ukraine designed to achieve the strategic defeat of Russia. And that, of course, was Joe Biden's 4 years. Those times have passed. You know, the Ukraine policy was always an extreme policy that wasn't founded in the realities of the world as it exists today. You know, the Biden administration was desperate to retain the relevance of the rules-based international order, which, you know, the transatlantic relationship is sort of the poster child, you know, of this rules-based international order. But the world was moving in a different direction. Rather than sustaining American hegemony, the world was moving to a multipolarity, you know, BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, other institutions of this nature. And we now have an administration, the Trump administration, that recognizes this reality. It is making the adjustments necessary. The problem is we sustain American hegemony for far too long. And the Europeans placed too much emphasis on the sustainment of this hegemony to define themselves. And so now that the United States is breaking free of past practice, you know, Europe isn't making the transition with us. You know, Europe refuses to recognize that, you know, these foundational policy concepts are no longer valid. Europe is standing its ground, but really what it's doing is defending, you know, past practices that are indefensible. And the United States has made a break. That's where we're at right now. I'm not blaming Europe. I'm saying that, you know, both the United States and Europe are at fault for this split. But the problem is Europe has invested everything, its future, everything into this Ukrainian enterprise, into this gambit in Ukraine. Whereas the United States has made the decision that we're going to divorce ourselves from this and seek a totally different approach to resolving regional global conflicts, one that views Russia not as an enemy, but as a partner of stability. That's the antithesis of the approach that Europe has taken. And, you know, one of two things has to happen. Either the European plan for delay succeeds and they can hold off any major implementation of this newly declared policy objective of the United States under Donald Trump, hold off until November midterm elections, and then hope and pray that there is a result in these elections that empowers a Democratic Congress that can then paralyze the Trump administration seeking to further implementation of this new radical, you know, America First policy. Or they can stand their ground and collapse. You know, so it's a big gamble. It's a big gamble. Europe's gambling their future right now on this. But in the meantime, Europe has to come face to face with the reality that by standing their ground, they are creating a massive canyon between where they are and where the United States is heading. And, you know, this puts us at a fundamental disagreement. It's no longer a disagreement amongst friends. We are now beginning to view each other, you know, in terms that approach the kind of language that was used to describe the Russians. We are an enemy of Europe. I mean, the Danish intelligence service certainly thinks so. The Germans now are recognizing that there's a fundamental disconnect. You know, and so that'll put Europe in a very precarious position where they are at odds with Russia and odds with the United States simultaneously. That won't end well. unless a miracle happens for the Europeans, and that's, you know, political catastrophe for the Trump administration in the midterm elections.
In Deutschland und in Westeuropa wird die Kriegshysterie auf ein Maximum getrieben. NATO-Generalsekretär Rutte prophezeite jüngst in Berlin, Russland steht schon vor der Tür. Bundeskanzler Merz toppte das noch mit seiner Aussage, Putin wird nicht aufhören, genauso wenig wie 1938 das Sudetenland nicht gereicht hat. Er vergleicht damit nicht nur die Appeasement-Politik Ende der 1930er Jahre mit der aktuellen Politik der US-Regierung, sondern auch direkt Putin mit Hitler. Mal abgesehen davon, dass Merz Vorfahren hat, die selbst aktiv im Hitlerfaschismus mitgewirkt haben. Wie schätzt du diese historische Analogie ein? Kann man Putins Politik mit der von Adolf Hitler vergleichen und Trump mit Chamberlain?
No, not at all. I mean, this is, you know, historic revisionism of the extreme, of an extreme nature, designed to, you know, prop up. It's one of the interesting things when people use historical analogies. You know, oftentimes, especially extreme analogies such as comparing Putin to Hitler, etc., you gloss over, you know, the reality. And that's the purpose of this, to give you an example of how this has been done historically. You know, in August 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and occupied Kuwait. You know, there were, you know, it wasn't a defensible action, but the Iraqis put forward, you know, reasons, justifications for their actions that were based upon fact. You know, one of the facts is that the Kuwaitis were slant drilling oil, stealing Iraqi wealth, flooding the market with oil to suppress the price of oil in order to collapse the Iraqi economy, economic warfare. The other is that Iraq had longstanding historical claims on Kuwait, which, you know, it felt, given the behavior of the Kuwaitis, they were going to, you know, take action on. What it wasn't about was Saddam Hussein being the modern day equivalent of Adolf Hitler. These were uniquely regional issues tied to regional historical fact and, you know, at that time, contemporary behavior on the part of Kuwait. When Iraq first invaded Kuwait, the United States government accurately said, we can't allow this to stand because it poses a threat to regional and global oil security. Now, the American people made it clear that they weren't willing to go to war for oil. And so in October of 1990, George Herbert Walker Bush gave a speech in Texas where he likened Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler. He's the modern-day equivalent of Adolf Hitler, he said, that requires Nuremberg-like retribution. Now, using this extreme language, it was designed to create the concept of good versus evil instead of delving down into the you know, the gray nuances of oil security politics. That's what's happening here. You know, the what Merz is doing is simply trying to distract the population from digging deeper into the root causes of this conflict. For instance, to ask questions about Angela Merkel's stance regarding Minsk and what was the official German position from 2015 until 2022 when it came to implementation of Minsk? What was the German policy regarding NATO expansion? Was Germany aware of the consequences of facilitating the expansion of NATO, given Germany's foundational role in solidifying the not one inch eastward philosophy that was stolen to the Soviet Union back in 1990, 1991 during the period of German unification. This is a direction that Merz doesn't want the German people to go, because if they go this direction, they will start asking questions like, you know, why is Germany doing this? Why is Germany working hand in glove with Ukrainian nationalists who have an ideology that is reprehensible and linked to our own Nazi past? And then start asking questions about Russia and about Vladimir Putin, about the reality of the Russian government. No. That's not what Merz wants. So Merz comes in with this simplistic, ignorant, comparison between Putin and Hitler. It's simply a distraction, an effort to blind people with explosive rhetoric so that they don't ask questions about what's really happening.
Laut aktuellen Medienberichten plant die US-Regierung bereits für ein Europa jenseits der EU. So sieht das Magazin Defense One einen Zusammenhang zwischen der neuen Sicherheitsstrategie und dem Bestreben, die Kontakte etwa nach Ungarn, Italien, Polen und Österreich auszubauen. Diese vier Staaten sollen aus dem Dunstfeld der EU herausgezogen werden und damit vor allem aus der Abhängigkeit von Deutschland und Frankreich. Welche Vision hat die Trump-Regierung für Europa? Welche Rolle hat die EU noch dabei?
But, this isn't unique to the Trump administration. I would imagine that most Germans of a certain age are familiar with Donald Rumsfeld and the lead up to the Iraq War, where, having pitched, the case for war to Europe and being told by Germany, France, and others that NATO was not interested in going to war in Iraq on behalf of the United States, Rumsfeld turned to the newer nations of the European community, the Eastern European nations, former Warsaw Pact nations. And he spoke of there being an old Europe and a new Europe. And he drove a wedge between the two. This is a standard American practice. I remind the Europeans that you only exist as an extension of our national security and foreign policy imperatives. And the moment you no longer are useful to facilitating the goals and objectives of the United States, we have no use for you, and we will dump you, as we did in the lead up to the Iraq War, where we, split Europe up. That's what's happening right now. I mean, there's a fundamental divide in Europe today. The idea of a unified European Union is a fabrication. There are nations right now that are not happy with the direction the European Union is heading. The United States isn't happy with the direction the European Union is heading. So the United States is seeking to divide and conquer. And so what we're going to do is dump those European nations that don't see eye to eye with us and rally around those European nations that do. I mean, the G7 is supposed to be the group of seven economies, which is dominated by Europe. They've got some, the Japanese are thrown in there for humor, I guess. But what is the Trump administration's, counter? The core five. Just a total reimagination of the economic center of gravity for the world that, that weakens Europe's grasp on relevancy. This is what's happening. Now, again, first of all, I have to tell the Europeans, in my opinion, this is inevitably the direction that we're heading. This is the reality of history, the reality of facts. But if if Europe tries hard and is successful, there can be an outcome in November that allows Europe and the United States to reimagine an artificial world that could survive another 2 years. But when it does collapse, and it will collapse, it just makes the divide between the collective West and the rest of the world that much greater. The best thing that Europe could do is recognize the inevitability of the demise of what they call the European Union today and seek to get Europe on a track that is compatible with, a multipolar world. Maybe this could actually create the conditions that allow a European Union to survive, but a European Union would have to be radically restructured so that it reflected the reality of the world, not the fiction of this transatlantic relationship between the European Union and the United States.
Liebe Zuschauer, wenn euch unsere Beiträge gefallen, teilt sie unbedingt in den sozialen Medien. Abonniert unseren Kanal und drückt auf die Glocke, damit ihr keine Veröffentlichung von Gegenpol verpasst.